Apologies. There's no podcast of today's background briefing due to copyright, and there'll be no transcript either. The program is, however, audio streamed, if you'd like to hear it. The podcast today is a repeat of Ian Townsend's Eureka Prize-winning investigation of how society will handle self-inflicted illnesses.
It's Saturday night in Brisbane's Fortitude Valley. At one in the morning, thousands of people are in the streets. Many are drunk and a few are stumbling and falling. A fight breaks out. It's a 5-minute ambulance ride or a 20-minute walk to the emergency department of the Royal Brisbane and Women's Hospital. In the early hours of Sunday morning, the casualties trickle in. At 2 a.m, a young man walks in, led by a girl in a tight pink dress. He's holding a bloodied rag over his mouth. Later, people arrive, bleeding from falls and fights. Someone's had a beer glass broken in their face. A man lies unconscious on a stretcher with his neck in a brace. The hospital's emergency specialist is Dr. David Rosengren.
Look, it can be the whole range of things. It can be people who have been assaulted, bashed in whatever form by someone else, or people who have simply injured themselves by either tripping over, falling over balconies, walking out in front of cars, just the whole range of sorts of accidents you'd expect from people who are disinhibited or overestimate their physical prowess.
It's estimated that every day in Queensland, 1,200 people affected by alcohol end up in hospital emergency departments. No one's quite sure how much all of this is costing, because emergency departments record injuries and illnesses, but not usually the cause. Several studies, though, say that alcohol's involved in a quarter to a third of all emergency cases in the country.
We could estimate that maybe 20 to 30% of emergency department presentations will have alcohol as a contributing factor in some form or another, whether that be alcohol forming chronic disease or alcohol, you know, producing acute illness, trauma, those sorts of things.
How many people are we talking about?
Oh, look, if, for example, the Royal Brisbane Emergency Department sees 220, 250 patients in a day, then if 20% of them were alcohol-related, then we're looking at maybe 30, 40 patients a day coming in with an alcohol-related problem.
That's just one hospital. Queensland's emergency departments treated 380,000 people in the first 3 months of this year. That's around 100,000 alcohol-related cases in just 3 months. Hello, I'm Ian Townsend, and welcome to Background Briefing on ABC Radio National, abc.net.au/rn. The cost of drinking, smoking, and eating too much is enormous, and the diseases they cause are choking hospitals. If you've had to wait for hours in a hospital emergency department, you might be aware of the system called triage. The most critically ill or injured get treated first. Dr. David Rosengren.
If anything, people with alcohol-related illnesses will be up-triaged and given an increased level of urgency on the basis that they're difficult to assess, they're unreliable with their history, and that particularly for trauma or, you know, patients with injuries, it's easy to say that their behaviour or their, you know, altered conscious states due to alcohol, when in fact we have to be absolutely confident that it's not due to, say, an injury to their brain or some other form of concussive head injury.
If an adult man chooses to get drunk and then he's injured, you might conclude that it was his own fault, but we all pick up his bill. That's in the emergency department. When alcohol causes chronic disease, it's a different story. For things like liver transplants, a different type of triage is practiced, and it can be based on economics as much as medicine. The director of the Australian Centre for Economic Research is Luke Connolly.
The question always then becomes one of what is the opportunity cost? Who are we avoiding treating as a result of treating this individual who, you know, perhaps needs a liver transplant and we believe is going to continue to drink? Well, the opportunity cost may be a non-drinker who needs a liver transplant for some other reason and may live a longer life. So the economics of that situation would be, in terms of rationing, which transplant is going to give us the greatest additional benefit.
Last month, a young man in the UK died after being refused a liver transplant. At 22, Gary Reinbach was an alcoholic, and doctors wouldn't give him an emergency life-saving transplant because he couldn't prove he could stay off the grog. It's a rare case, but this sort of decision is fueling a debate about self-inflicted diseases and the price individuals should bear for their own bad habits. In the UK, the debate about who should pay is being billed as a test of society's moral fibre. Professor of Medical Law and Ethics, Charles Foster, says society itself is at stake, and he's on the phone from Oxford.
It's an absolutely crucial debate. It goes to the root of what we perceive human beings to be as individuals. It goes to the root of what we see society as being. Should society be, as I've suggested it should, one which regards sick people as particularly valued members of its community? And there is a poverty of debate, at least in our parliament, about these issues. It's a shame, because unless there's a debate about these most fundamental issues in our parliaments, we're going to get lots of other things wrong, way distant from the realm of healthcare.
We heard earlier from emergency medicine specialist Dr. David Rosengren, who said that the medical costs of alcohol-related injuries are hidden because emergency departments don't keep the statistics. When you look at the statistics of all the things we do that put our own health at risk, it's actually smoking that tops the list. Every week, Brisbane thoracic surgeon Morgan Windsor removes tumours from the lungs of smokers. Most patients diagnosed with lung cancer get around 9 months to live and aren't offered an operation. Surgery might save the lives of only a third of people diagnosed with lung cancer. For those few, surgeons have insisted that if they're still smoking, they should quit or at least cut down if they want a better chance of surviving surgery. Dr. Morgan Windsor.
You can take them on their word that they've cut down from 50 a day to 2 a day. Is that good enough? I don't know. I don't think it's really for me to answer that. Yes, the risk of complications is higher. Yes, that might cost the public health purse more if they get those complications. Personally, for me, I don't think it's for me to make that decision to withhold treatment. If someone at a higher level who can actually truly controls the funding wants to make that decision, then I'm happy to let them go down that path.
At the highest level, it's governments who control the funding and hold our lives in their hands. Hospital budgets are stretched and medical decisions are increasingly being made based on how much something costs. Federal Department of Health statistics show that the net cost of treating smoking-related illnesses such as lung cancer, emphysema and heart disease is $318 million a year. But the federal government gets 20 times that amount, $7 billion a year, from tobacco taxes. The raw statistics often don't tell the full story. In this case, the government economist reached that figure of $318 million by adding up the money actually spent to treat smokers, which is around $1.8 billion, and then subtracting the money saved by smokers dying prematurely. It's the sort of statistic that the writers of the BBC series Yes, Prime Minister probably had in mind back in 1986 when they wrote a program called The Smokescreen. Here, the British Prime Minister, Jim Hacker, has just finished meeting with his health minister. The PM's permanent secretary, Sir Humphrey Appleby, is at the door.
Ah, Prime Minister.
Humphrey.
I was just wondering, did you have an interesting chat with Dr. Thorne?
Yes. He proposed the elimination of smoking.
By a campaign of mass hypnosis, perhaps.
By raising tobacco taxes sky high, yeah, and simultaneously banning all advertising, including a point of sale. Don't you think his position is admirably moral?
Moral, perhaps, but extremely silly. No man in his right mind could possibly contemplate such a proposal.
I'm contemplating it.
Yes, of course, Prime Minister. Please, don't misunderstand me. It is quite right, of course, that you should contemplate all proposals that come from your government, but no sane man would ever support it.
I'm supporting it.
And quite right, too. problem is that the tax on tobacco is a major source of revenue for the government.
It's also a major source of deaths from killer diseases.
Yes, indeed, but no definite causative link has ever been proved, has it?
The statistics are unarguable.
Statistics, you can prove anything with statistics.
Even the truth.
It's still funny in a grim sort of way, but the truth is that the diseases caused by cigarettes, alcohol, eating too much and not getting enough exercise will kill many of us before our time. Making ourselves sick is becoming a luxury we, as a society, can't afford unless we raise taxes sky high. As we've heard, though, smokers are the exception. They already pay their way. Here's how the BBC programme Yes, Prime Minister puts it.
Humphrey, we're talking about 100,000 deaths a year.
Yes, but cigarette taxes pay for a third of the cost of the National Health Service. We're saving many more lives than we otherwise could because of those smokers who voluntarily lay down their lives for their friends. Smokers are national benefactors.
So long as they live.
Not that any definite causal link has ever been proved, as I said before.
It's time for your next cabinet committee, Prime Minister. Then you're lunching at the House, where the Minister for Sport wants an urgent word.
What about?
Sponsorship.
Who tipped him off?
Most cases of heart disease, strokes, liver failure, lung cancers and diabetes are avoidable, and you'd think it'd be a good idea to simply stop doing the things that cause them. But that's easier said than done. It's not just about having the willpower to say no. Our ability to control our health can depend as much on where we live and how much we earn. Professor of Health Law and Governance at the Sydney Law School, Roger Magnusson.
Well, there's a tendency for everyone to think about non-communicable diseases in terms of individual risk factors and the things that individuals can do to be healthy, you know, stop smoking, eat right, exercise, get a grip. And yet, if we look at the patterns of illness across the population, the influences upon illness don't only relate to an individual's choices, they relate to other factors that are beyond the control of individuals. The socioeconomic environment and the physical environment can often influence whether or not we smoke, what we eat, how much exercise we get. People who live busy urban lives find it difficult to get exercise, for example. There's also a great deal of evidence to show that people of low socioeconomic status are more likely to be obese, they're more likely to smoke. And so these are the kinds of things that support the argument that people are partly responsible for their own health through the choices they make, but they're not wholly responsible.
Think about smoking. In the 1950s, nearly three quarters of adults smoked, and we died on average 10 years younger than we do today. Smoking rates didn't fall dramatically until the government jacked up taxes and started banning advertising 15 to 20 years ago.
And the real question is whether we think government has a role in responding to those patterns of behaviour that increase the burden of ill health in our society. Now, you might say, no, they don't, in which case you just leave it all up to the individual. But the evidence suggests that individuals aren't making particularly good choices when it comes to their food, for example. You know, the last two decades have seen a quite remarkable rise in obesity, and there's no suggestion that that is going to change simply by lecturing individuals to eat healthily. So we need to consider whether government has a role and what that role might be in creating the conditions for healthier lifestyles, because I think we all want to be healthy at the end of the day. I've not yet come across a cheer squad of people celebrating their diabetes or criticising tobacco control while they breathe oxygen through a tube.
Law Professor Roger Magnusson. In the past 20 years, most adult smokers have quit smoking, but 3 million Australians still smoke. While the incidence of heart attacks and strokes has plummeted, there's a worrying anomaly. Rates of lung cancer have continued climbing. About 30 new cases of lung cancer are diagnosed every week in Queensland, and the survival rates aren't good. Only about 10 will be offered surgery. For the other 20, it's too late. 9 months to live is often the prognosis. Recently, doctors diagnosing lung cancer have noticed that ex-smokers and people who've never smoked now outnumber smokers.
So this is a left lung with the upper and lower parts, and this is a cancer that's growing across between the two parts of it. And we really, you know, would only do surgery if we thought that there was a chance of cure. And this one, I think, actually is tuberculosis, some cancer as well.
So how often would you have to, would you make the decision not to operate because it was pointless?
Oh, well, look, unfortunately, that's the majority of patients.
The director of thoracic surgery at Brisbane's Prince Charles Hospital is Dr. Morgan Windsor.
Unfortunately for ex-smokers, the risk of developing lung cancer drops very slowly, if at all, over the ensuing years. The majority of patients that we see presenting for surgery for lung cancer are in fact ex-smokers. It's not a large majority, but more than 50%.
Brisbane's Prince Charles Hospital has a lung cancer database that goes back to the year 2000. One of the startling things it shows is the rising rates of lung cancer in young women who've never smoked.
We are seeing these cancers developing in younger patients, and we've had patients in their 20s and 30s, predominantly women, some of whom have been non-smokers developing primary lung cancer, and that's obviously a devastating diagnosis for them. They always say that, well, why have I got this? Lung cancer is a disease of smokers, and that becomes very difficult to explain.
No one's quite sure why, but doctors are looking at possible genetic causes, pollution, and even viruses. For some older non-smokers with lung cancer, passive smoking is often blamed.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Natalie, is it?
Yes.
How are you?
The old Brisbane suburb of Camp Hill is hemmed in by busy roads, but has streets of large Queenslander houses on stilts.
Come in.
3 years ago, Natalie Coffey was diagnosed with lung cancer. She's never smoked a cigarette.
Well, you know, I have been subjected to a lot of tobacco smoke over the years and sort of flying. Everyone smoked on aeroplanes, and I was always surrounded by people who were smoking, particularly my mother-in-law and husband, and they just smoked all night, and I'm half dying there between the two of them. But there was so much smoking when I was growing up, and everybody accepted it. You know, it sort of used to float around the rooms and houses. In the cars, you smoked in the cars all the time. I suppose my children could even end up with passive smoking.
But when she tells people about her lung cancer, everyone assumes she's a smoker.
Oh, I said, what, are you a smoker? That's the first thing they all say, are you a smoker? And I would say, no, I've never smoked. You know, I've never put a cigarette in my mouth, but I've ended up with the passive smoking. A lot of people blame it on the person for causing it, but what could you do if you lived in those times and you get into a group that smoke? Majority of people get caught up in that particular way, yeah.
Natalie Coffey's lung cancer isn't self-inflicted, but we've grown to think of lung cancer as a smoker's disease, and many people have little sympathy for the victims.
Hi, how are you? Good to see you. I was around the corner.
Come on in. As it
turns the out. Australian Lung Foundation has its headquarters in a small, neat office in inner Brisbane. It raises money for research into all sorts of lung diseases, and it keeps its 15,000 members up to date with research and treatments. Lung cancer is the country's biggest cancer killer. 9,000 people are diagnosed a year, and last year, 7,800 died. When diagnosed, many blame themselves because society's been telling them it's their own fault. The Lung Foundation's chief executive is William Derbyshire.
Some people think, oh, well, it's my fault, I had it coming to me, I won't seek treatment. And, you know, even if there is no cure, you can certainly, people can have a better quality of life in the latter part of their days. And I know there's been some debates about people, you know, being accountable for their smoking, but, you could say the same for AIDS, and you could say the same for obesity and many other lifestyle, you know, non-communicable diseases.
And about anything else we've done where we've risked our health. If there's a big search for someone missing at sea or in the bush, and they're rescued at great expense, there are often calls for that person to pay the rescue bill. The argument goes that if they're silly enough to get lost, knowing the dangers, then the taxpayer shouldn't have to pay for their mistake. But as we've heard earlier, if you do the sums a certain way, in the case of smoking at least, the government makes more from tobacco than they pay to treat the tobacco-related illnesses.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thanks for Luke.
In the old Brisbane Medical School, next to the Royal Brisbane Hospital, is the Australian Centre for Economic Research. The centre's director is a professor of health economics, Luke Connolly.
Mostly that literature suggests that smokers do pay their way, so that the tax revenue that's collected from smokers tends to exceed the healthcare costs they impose. Some of the literature on alcohol consumption is less straightforward, or at least doesn't show that result. It tends to show that heavy drinkers tend to impose more costs than the revenue they generate via taxes, and that's largely due to what economists call negative externalities. So these are the harms that are done to other people when individuals drink, the external effects like drunk driving and violence and other things that are associated with heavy consumption of alcohol tend to outweigh the tax revenue.
The federal government's received several reports in the past few weeks, all saying that our health system's heading for its own coronary and recommending radical treatment. A report by the National Preventative Health Task Force has been looking at the burden of self-inflicted diseases. It's understood to back higher taxes on alcohol and junk food along the lines of tobacco. That specific report also recommends laws that restrict the way junk food is advertised. It worked for tobacco, banning tobacco advertising and pushing up the price through taxes over the past 20 years has caused smokers to quit in droves and fewer people to take it up. But 3 million Australians still smoke. That's a lot of people. When economists look at those figures, they wonder whether the markets somehow failed. The warnings have been dire, the financial and health costs are high, and people must be aware of the dangers by now. Health economist Luke Connolly.
Economists tend to say, what's the source of the problem? If individuals understand their behaviour, they understand the consequences of it, they know the costs and the benefits of it, then perhaps there isn't any source of market failure in that regard.
People just simply are prepared to take the risk.
That's right. I mean, you know, some people would rather be able to eat chocolate all their lives and live slightly less and have the odd drink and fatty meal and so on. And I think economists just simply realise that then recognise the trade-offs that are involved in all of these things. I mean, similarly, in relation to taking risks, you know, some of the healthiest members of our community cycle on the roads every day and take risks of being fatally fatally injured on the roads. So we all take risks and we all make these trade-offs.
That's an interesting example, isn't it, cycling? Because that's a health risk associated with trying to become healthier. And I'm not sure that looking at all the people that I know that have had accidents, it seems to be, on balance, unhealthier to cycle, especially in Brisbane.
Yes, well, you know, I have first-hand experience of this, and having tried to fight overweight and obesity by getting onto a bike and then getting hit by a car, and you know, as a fairly risk-averse cyclist as well. So I think that, once again, these are all risks that we take, and we know when we jump on the bike that we're taking that risk, and we assess the benefits as being as outweighing the potential costs, and in my case, reassess after being hit by a car.
Trying to find out why we take risks with our health when we know better is keeping a lot of researchers busy. I'm taking a rickety lift to the floor above the Centre for Economic Research to another centre, the Australian Centre for the Burden of Disease and Cost Effectiveness, which is part of the University of Queensland's School of Population Health. Its job is to look at the statistics and come up with things that governments can do to improve our health. Back in the 1970s, we could drink and drive without seatbelts. We ate a lot of saturated animal fats, and most adults smoked. Men in their 50s were regularly keeling over from heart attacks, about 10 years younger and 2.5 times the rate they do today. And all those premature deaths saved governments a lot of money. Many men worked, paid their taxes, and promptly died around retirement age, before they became an economic burden on society. Taking the cold economic view, it suited the government's balance sheet for us to die younger. In fact, a paper published in the New England Journal of Health found that if everyone stopped smoking, healthcare costs would rise. That's because over a lifetime, smokers are the cheapest to treat. They die younger from heart disease and cancer.
Yeah. Hi.
Hi.
Ian Townsend.
Hi, Ian.
The director of the Centre for the Burden of Disease is Theo Voss.
A lot of controversy about this line of thinking, because in terms of expenditure to the health system, it's fantastic if someone drops dead within a short time from their lung cancer at age 40. But, of course, you know, as a society, we're not happy 40-year-olds to drop dead from lung cancer. So you could have a line of argument that, you know, it's actually good for the health system for people to die young, but that's, you know, flies in the face of what anybody will give you as their wishes of what would happen in society.
So over a lifetime, who would be the most expensive people for the health system to treat? Is it the people who smoke and perhaps die at the age of 65, or the people who are reasonably healthy, like you and I, and live till we're 90.
What we tend to find is that we live longer, but we also have less health problems for most of that extended life period. The only time when it starts to flip over is, our estimates are around about age 80. So we do pay a price that's over the age of 80, you know, big sort of health problems start to pile up.
Theo Voss from the Centre for the Burden of Disease, which has produced 14 risk factors that account for just about all self-inflicted diseases and injuries. It reads like a modern version of the seven deadly sins, which were lust, gluttony, greed, sloth, wrath, envy, and pride. The modern 14 deadly risks include lack of exercise, unsafe sex, not eating enough veggies, high blood pressure, too much alcohol, smoking, and too much weight. Those 14 risks account for about a third of what's called health loss in Australia today. Health loss is the time people lose out of their productive lives when they get sick or die young. And you can find a link to the 14 health risks on the Background Briefing website at abc.net.au/rn. On that list, from the highest to the lowest, alcohol comes in sixth, just behind physical inactivity, or as we used to say, sloth. Top of the list is tobacco, accounting for about 20% of all cancers and 10% of heart diseases. It's a legacy that's lingering from a time when we were more blasé about our health. If you're old enough, you might recall some of the old cigarette ads that urged you to smoke a certain brand. They told you it'd make you look good and smart, and it couldn't possibly hurt.
You know, if you were to follow a busy doctor as he makes his daily round of calls, you'd find yourself having a mighty busy time keeping up with him. Time out, for many men of medicine, usually means just long enough to enjoy a cigarette.
Background Briefing wanted to play in full this 1949 commercial from the US on YouTube, but we've had legal advice that we might be breaching the strict Tobacco Advertising Prohibition Act. The Act says that a cigarette ad can't be broadcast at all. There's no allowance for old ads, even if they sound plain silly nowadays, and would persuade no one to take up smoking. This law is a recognition that advertising is very powerful and smoking addictive. It's a measure of how seriously the government takes the dangers of tobacco and the strong and sometimes subtle forces that can lead to chronic diseases. Many of the people who took up smoking in 1949, when that ad was being played, are the ones now coming into hospitals with heart disease and lung cancer.
I think I'll have just one, maybe just another one. Of course the third one's so much fun. But he'll never leave you alone. tell it to go. You'll just turn around and bring it right back home. I think it's time for a puff. One should be enough. It shouldn't have to be this tough.
That's a song about addiction called I'll Never Leave You Alone by the Canadian band The Crash Test Dummies. We all know how hard it is to give up cigarettes or alcohol or sweet fattening foods, even when we know they're doing damage. In the UK, Oxford University recently hosted an online debate entitled Should the NHS, the National Health Service, treat self-inflicted illnesses? In other words, should the taxpayer foot the bill if someone gets cancer from smoking or an alcoholic needs a new liver? One of the debaters is Oxford barrister Charles Foster.
It is a terribly punitive thing to do, to say, right, you got it wrong, and therefore, effectively, we're going to deny you the treatment which will allow you to continue to live, to continue to be a member of society, to continue to live as a human being. It seems to me that if society really is worth anything at all, it should be characterized by compassion. It should recognize that it exists for the very people who make mistakes, who live imperfect lives, who sometimes make wrong decisions. It doesn't just exist for perfected saints who always make the right decisions about everything. If it existed only for those people, it wouldn't exist for anybody at all, because nobody fulfills that description.
At the start of the program, we were at Night Spots in Fortitude Valley, a part of Brisbane that's always had a reputation for sin. Many of those 14 health risks that the Centre for the Burden of Diseases talked about are being taken here tonight. In such a big crowd, you can see patterns of risky behaviour, young men being aggressive, and a lot of young women smoking. Almost all the people here are young. We're not quite in control of our own behaviour. The sorts of bad habits we end up developing can depend on our sex, our age, our income. Some of us might have genes that predispose us to addictions or diseases. But no one thing can easily explain the state of our health. Professor of Health Law, Roger Magnusson.
Genes can help to explain the individual health trajectory of you or I, simply because we've inherited good genes or bad genes. But they can't really explain the rapid trend, for example, towards population weight gain over the past couple of decades, because our genome hasn't changed in that time. So I think genes and genetic solutions are important for an individual's health, but they're not going to make a lot of difference to population health. What's important to population health is the environment, the social and economic factors that influence patterns of lifestyle and patterns of decision. So if we want to reverse the trend towards obesity or smoking-related illness or diabetes or heart disease, then we have to address the factors that make these diseases common within populations. And we need then to pay attention to the environment, the things that condition our behaviour, not just to our genes, which we inherited from our forebears.
One of the things that can condition our behaviour is price. If the government raises taxes high enough on things like tobacco, alcohol and junk food, then we'll be more reluctant to buy them. Putting a financial penalty on risks is something the insurance industry does. So if you live in a suburb where there's a lot of crime, or if you drive a fast car or you've had a lot of crashes, you pay more for your car insurance. With health insurance, though, it doesn't quite work like that. Health insurance companies have to abide by a system called community rating, which makes sure everyone pays the same premium for their health insurance, regardless of how much they smoke, drink, or eat. the health insurance industry would prefer the sort of risk rating that other forms of insurance use. They'd like to be able to charge high-risk people, such as smokers, more money, which they say would also encourage healthier behaviour. Health economist Luke Connolly.
The regulation in this industry is fairly heavy as well, and so any new policy needs to be approved by the minister. So if a firm, for example, came to the minister with a new policy with exclusions for, say, cancer or smoking-related cancer, then they'd have to get past the minister first to have that approved, and it's very unlikely, I think, that those types of policies would be approved, because they also, I guess, fly in the face of the principles of open enrolment and community rating.
The health insurance industry is always bending the ear of the government, and so are various other industry and health lobby groups. We heard earlier from the Lung Foundation, a lobby group with 15,000 members. It says it's up against a still powerful tobacco industry. The government gets $7 billion a year from tobacco taxes. The Lung Foundation's executive director is William Derbyshire.
Yes, they're very, very powerful, and they, of course, have massive resources available to them. They have all sorts of tricks. You might have seen, you know, a few TV programs of people smoking, trying to make it look glamorous, and a lot of the movies have smoking in now.
But what influence could a tobacco company have in Canberra still?
I suppose you'd really want to turn that question around and say, what would Treasury do without the $7 billion? You know, that's obviously a huge thing. And I've heard reports, anecdotal reports, of health ministers saying 18% smoking rates, I'm comfortable with that. And it took me a while to work out why they were comfortable with that. But of course, it must be connected with the huge cash inflow from the excise.
The government also saves a lot of money if some of us die young from smoking. The other problem the Lung Foundation has is that lung diseases like cancer and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD, are so closely linked to smoking that people who have them often get little sympathy. The perception is that their disease is self-inflicted.
We wheeled a patient around the Houses of Parliament in Canberra not so long ago, and we had Professor Frith, the chairman of our COPD national program, and we had a patient, and we had sort of 10 minutes with 10 MPs, and they were all very receptive, except for one, who's basically said, if you're a smoker, you know, I'm not interested, you just piss off, basically, and I'm going to want to have my Vegemite sandwich. And that was 1 in 10, so I don't know whether that's a representative sample or not.
There's a popular view that governments shouldn't meddle in our decisions about our health. Public health policies are always hotly debated, pitting public good against the rights of individuals. It was the British Conservative MP, Ian McLeod, who's been credited with coining the term nanny state. McLeod was Minister for Health in 1952 when he famously smoked through a press conference where a doctor was announcing that he could prove the link between smoking and lung cancer. Ian McLeod died aged 56 after a heart attack, by the way. Earlier in the program, we heard part of the 1980s TV series Yes, Prime Minister. In this scene, a group of public servants is wondering how to talk a fictional health minister, Peter Thorne, out of raising tobacco taxes and banning cigarette advertising.
I mean, what's he know about the subject? Peter Thorne is only a doctor. I mean, his sole purpose is keeping people alive.
Must be biased. Yes. Seeing your patients die must emotionally distort your judgment.
Of course.
Very understandable. But a great handicap to cool decision-taking.
Right.
Very true, but can we find something a bit stronger?
Well, Frank, you know, I think the crucial argument is that we're living in a free country and we must be free to make our own decisions. After all, government shouldn't be a nursemaid. We don't want the nanny state.
Oh, that's very excellent.
The only problem is that that is also the argument for legalising the sale of marijuana, heroin, cocaine, arsenic and gelatin.
Well, maybe that's a good idea if we could put a big enough tax on them.
Politically difficult?
Pity.
Yes.
A few weeks back, the University of Sydney held a debate entitled Welcome Back Nanny, Civil Liberties and the Public Good. This debate coincided with the New South Wales government's decision to fine parents who smoked in cars while children were present.
Among the speakers was former Liberal Health Minister Tony Abbott.
Well, you know, I was a child that was regularly imprisoned in a car with heavy smokers. You know, my parents both smoked heavily when I was a kid, and they smoked heavily wherever they were, including in the car. Now, has it done me any harm? Well, yes, you be the judge. You be the judge. I mean, maybe but for that, I would have been 6'6", and I would have had much greater intelligence. Who knows? But if I was the relevant legislator, I wouldn't do it. I would probably hope that it didn't happen. You know, I'd be inclined to say that smoking in the car with the kids, while regrettable, is probably far from the worst thing you can do. I personally would not get hung up on something, in my view, as trivial as smoking while the kids are in the car.
On the other side of that debate in Sydney was Professor Mike Daube from Curtin University. He's the president of the Public Health Association, and he also happens to be deputy chair of the government's Preventative Health Task Force, which last month delivered a big report to the federal government advising it how to tackle self-inflicted diseases. Professor Daube told the audience he didn't think exposing kids to cigarette smoke in cars was trivial. And after the debate, he foreshadowed an even bigger nanny state measure, an attack on junk food advertising.
Our kids are currently being exposed to a tidal wave of promotion for junk food. It's not just advertising, it's promotion through sports sponsorship. We found when we looked at one form of sports sponsorship for junk food that the name of the sponsor was on screen for 61% of playing time. There's massive exposure of kids to junk food, and our kids are fat and getting fatter. So many of them. We have obesity as a major national problem, so what we need, I think, is to look very seriously at the constraints there should be on junk food promotion.
The battle lines in the fight for better public health are being drawn under advertising. Professor of Health Law at the Sydney Law School, Roger Magnusson.
Food advertising works, otherwise the industry wouldn't do it. And so if we were to constrain the advertising of unhealthy food, particularly to children, then we would get what we call a population health effect. We would get, across the population as a whole, less consumption of those kinds of unhealthy foods. And that'll be good for kids. It'll also provide an economic incentive to industry to market better products. It's not that people will stop eating. It's just that the opportunities for industry will need to be in the healthier food market as distinct from the unhealthy food market.
Making money within the law is what companies do. But if we're not happy with how they try to sell us things, Professor Magnusson says governments must be prepared to rein companies in.
But really, the real issue underlying all this is money. It's not liberty. Often what people are really arguing about when they're throwing the nanny word about is whether or not industry should be constrained at all in its activities by government or not.
Many of the things we now take for granted were once derided as being the nanny state gone mad. Things like seatbelts, bicycle helmets, tobacco advertising bans, and workplace smoking laws. The hard thing to grasp is that entire populations don't behave like individuals. If you want to improve the health of an entire country, it doesn't work to tell us all to get a grip, eat our veggies, and stop drinking so much. But if the government increases taxes on highly sugared soft drinks, for example, it mightn't worry you so much personally, but across the nation, it'll cause a sharp drop in soft drink sales. Professor Roger Magnusson.
So if you are to, you know, marginally increase the price through taxation of foods that are high in salt or high in fat, people are, you know, in general, less likely to consume those foods. But they may not do so through any conscious decision, but you may still have that health impact, but it won't be mediated through a conscious lifestyle choice. You know, if you want to improve dental health. You can lecture people about brushing their teeth, or you can put fluoride in the water supply. And lo and behold, you improve the dental health of the entire population, but that improvement is not mediated through the conscious choice or behaviour of any individual.
And similarly, blaming individuals for their own self-inflicted diseases not only doesn't work, but it's unfair. When lung cancer patient Natalie Coffey was first exposed to cigarette smoke, it was at a time when we really didn't understand the risks. We now know that genes and pollution can also play a role. If Natalie Coffey went to court to find who was to blame, it'd be almost impossible to find a direct cause for her cancer. We can see the link clearly between smoking and lung cancer when we look at the entire population. 10 to 15% of smokers will get lung cancer, and it's very rare in everyone else. But in an individual, it's still hard to prove. Natalie Coffey says no one who gets lung cancer deserves it, and if anyone should pay to treat the disease, it's the society that encouraged smoking in the first place.
I don't think we should have to pay, because they were selling them, you know, so they were saying how good they were, and once there's an addiction to something, it's very hard to give up. So again, can you blame the individual because they were out there? I blame the advertising people, the people who are involved in selling the product. Maybe they need to be, I really think they've just got to stop, the government's got to stop them being made, produced, and just leave it at that, because they're all the time pushing it, you know. There you are, you walk into the front of the shop, you've got the big counter with every cigarette packet there.
Until she was forced to retire because of her lung cancer, Natalie Coffey was a home economics teacher. It was her job to teach children how to eat well and how to avoid drugs, tobacco and alcohol. She's worried that those lessons have taken a back seat in schools, when they're now more important than ever.
Well, it's just such a useful sort of thing for the kids. They became more aware, and I think what happened, well, I blame society really, because I think both parents work because of the necessity of working. The children aren't eating as well as they should. They don't want to study as hard as they would like to, and they want to forget about unpleasant things in the world, and they just go and smoke and drink and, you know, things that I think they... It's not very good for them, but... Yeah, that's part of what they're doing, I think, nowadays.
We've inherited many of our health problems from a time when we knew less about self-inflicted diseases. It wasn't that long ago when war, infectious disease and work injuries were bigger, immediate dangers. Now, most of us live long enough to see the results of a lifetime of smoking, drinking and eating the wrong foods. Unfortunately, if we keep doing many of those bad things that we enjoy, it's going to cost us all more than we can afford. Professor Roger Magnusson.
If we're not happy with the rising rates of obesity in children, if we're not happy with the fact that 3 million Australians smoke still and that 50% of those, if they continue to do so, will probably die from it, if we're not happy with that, we need to be prepared to regulate, and in some cases regulate quite stringently. It comes down to the sort of society that we would like to have, whether we would like to live healthy, long, productive lives, or whether we would like to give ourselves a kind of radical liberty to undermine our own health.
Background Briefing's coordinating producer is Linda McGuinness. Technical operator, Mark Don. Research, Anna Whitfeld. Executive producer is Kirsten Garrett. I'm Ian Townsend, and you're listening to ABC Radio National.
Hi, Natasha Mitchell from All in the Mind. Meet stand-up comic CJ Jones. a master storyteller in sign language.
Remember, sign language comes with facial expression, body language, movement. It's all incorporated together.
Filmmaker Hilary Scarl.
Yeah, sign language really changed me as a person, too. There's some things that are very particular to deaf culture, like it's very particular to be blunt.
Neuroscientist Karen Emery.
One of the things that sign languages tell us is about the drive for human language. Wherever deaf people come together, a language emerges.
The science of sign language transforming our understanding of all human language in the brain.
So when people say, oh, I'm sorry you're deaf, I say, nothing wrong with being deaf, so what? As long as I have good education, I'm fine, I'm married, I produce children, hello?
That's all in the mind. Listen or download from the Radio National website.